Next matter is entitled Donald Ward versus Summa Health System. While the attorneys are coming forward, I do want to take this opportunity to extend a welcome to our friends from the Ukraine. I see that you've joined us this morning. Mr. Lake.
Chief Justice Brown, may it please the Court, my name is Doug Leake, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, non-party Dr. Robert Depsky, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal. On behalf of Dr. Depsky, we ask that you reverse the Ninth District decision and reinstate the trial court's protective order that was properly entered in his favor. The Ninth District, in interpreting Ohio's physician-patient privilege in Revised Code 23-1702B1, erroneously concluded that even though the patient is the exclusive holder of the physician-patient privilege, a patient is not a protected source when it comes to personal medical information.
Can you help me understand why the doctor has been referred to as a patient?
Because it is the personal medical information of Dr. Depsky that they are seeking to compel. It is his own personal medical information.
I understand that, but is there a doctor-patient relationship somewhere here with Dr. Depsky?
Yes. What the information they're trying to obtain from Dr. Depsky is information that was generated and exchange between him and his medical care providers. So it's the relationship between Dr. Depsky and his own physician. It is his own medical information.
All right. Is the question what his physician told him, the advice his physician gave him, or is the question what his personal knowledge is of what his health condition is?
Well, I think, first of all, the fact that he's a doctor himself should not make a difference, because it's the patient, Dr. Depsky himself, that holds the privilege. And any knowledge that he obtained about his medical diagnosis, treatment, any testing that they're trying to discover in this case is information derived from communications between Dr. Depsky and his medical care providers, whether it's a physician or some other medical care provider. So,
now
yes.
Counsel, now that he has that information about himself, they're not, I can see that there may be some areas of protection here. For example, if the question would be asked, what did your physician tell you when, you know, you discussed this condition with your physician, et cetera, et cetera. So, but to have a blanket prohibition against having your client discuss what happened in the surgery, and which he's willing to talk about, his role as a surgeon in this case. And he's willing to talk about what happened in the operating room and the treatment that he gave to Mr. Ward, correct?
Correct.
But what he's not willing to talk about is his own medical condition that presumably he had while performing this surgery, correct?
Exactly.
So if the questions are not asked of Dr. Depsky, what did your physician tell you? Did the physician give you any cautionary instructions? Were you, did you seek a second opinion? You know, all of the discussion precedent to his role in the operating room. And if the only question is, are you a carrier? And if that's the only question, and then, doctor, what did you do in the operating room, and what was the protocol and the procedures, I don't understand why that information is not relevant to the discovery by the appellee.
Well, first of all, I think you have to look at what that information is. That is personal medical information derived from the communications between Dr. Depsky. So you have to look at the status of that information, which is communications. And I think this court addressed it very well in the Roe versus Planned Parenthood case, that even if you redact personal identifying information, that does not strip the patient of the privilege, and it's the privilege of that communication that is protected in this case. And
But it's the privilege to have that information and not share it with other people for the purposes of, you know, for whatever purpose. You know, that's the impediment to the disclosure, and that's the reason. Without the patient saying, it's okay to share this information, correct? The patient can waive this.
Under Medical Mutual Schlatterer, this court said that the patient is the exclusive holder of the privilege and can only be compelled to disclose that information, personal medical information, by express consent or waiver. And so Dr. Debsky, as the exclusive holder of the privilege, has to, under Medical Mutual, provide express consent or a waiver of that information.
For that information to come from his medical provider or the hospital or whomever is the holder of those records, he doesn't need to waive his own ability to discuss his condition.
Well, I think the key is that information that he possesses, whether it's Dr. Debsky in his, you know, he's a doctor, yes, but he is the patient. That information that he possesses about whether or not he had hepatitis, the questions they want, when he contracted it or when was he tested for it, that is derived from the physician-patient relationship, and it's communications between the physician and the patient that is protected.
So in essence, when anybody that's a carrier of a disease infects another person, the person who's a carrier is never required to disclose to anybody that they have that disease? That seems to me to be the gist of your argument.
Well, first of all, I think we have to look at his status as a non-party and the Roe versus Planned Parenthood case. And I think that case is directly on point because he is a non-party to this. And in Roe versus Planned Parenthood...
But Mr. Leak, in Roe, wasn't the information sought from the provider, not from the patient?
Correct.
Isn't that a difference here? Doesn't it matter whether the request is directed to the healthcare provider or directed directly to the patient?
I believe what this court did in Roe versus Planned Parenthood was uphold the sanctity of the privacy rights of confidentiality of a patient. And I believe that if you take that approach, that you're allowed to ask the patient the information, it defeats the whole purpose of the intention of the legislature in the physician-patient privilege.
Well, Mr. Lake, are you suggesting then that, in Justice Cupp's example, that request, that question to the patient for information about their health care condition is different if that person has seen a doctor or they have not? What if they've never seen a doctor? Can't they be asked about their health care condition?
I think
and be required to answer the question?
I think that would have to take place in terms of determining under what circumstances that information was derived. And I think, as the Ninth District acknowledged in paragraph 25, was that this is communications between a physician and patient. That is not an issue here. This involves communications between Dr. Debsky and his medical care providers that falls under the physician-patient privilege. And I believe that the Ninth District even acknowledged that they were creating a conflict here. At paragraph 26 in its opinion, it says, on the one hand, the statute prevents a physician testifying about a physician-patient communication absent a waiver, yet it does not specifically prevent a patient from being compelled to disclose personal medical information. And I think the Ninth District acknowledged that that's a conflict. And by ignoring...
Counsel, it's only if that information is relevant to the proceedings. And that's... It's not your general medical history or your general medical condition. Here, there's an allegation that there was damage done to Mr. Ward as a result of the medical condition of the surgeon. Correct?
Yes.
All right. Nobody cares about any other aspect of his medical condition other than whether he was or is hepatitis infected. And so for the very limited purpose of the relationship, the causation between his current condition and that of Mr. Ward is the relevant issue here, not his condition in general, his medical, you know, status in general.
Well, I think that the First District Court of Appeals in Callahan versus Fullen addressed this very issue, because that was a case in which the plaintiff was trying to obtain information as to whether or not the defendant surgeon, in that case a defendant, not a non-party, mm-hmm. defendant surgeon had multiple sclerosis at the time of the surgery. And the First District in Callahan versus Fullen said that it's the privilege takes priority, even if that information may be relevant. And I think the Seventh District also recently in Bednarik versus St. Elizabeth in December of 2009, following this court's authority in Roe versus Planned Parenthood, acknowledged that the medical records being sought in that case was of a non-party roommate in a hospital setting. And the Seventh District followed this court's reasoning in Roe versus Planned Parenthood and said that does not allow discovery of a non-party patient. And I think it's very important that Dr. Debsky is a non-party to this action.
Mr. Leake, is there any ability of a trial court to order a medical examination of Dr. Debsky?
In terms of like an IME to
that's,
compel?
Along those lines is what I was thinking about.
Well,
why couldn't there be such an examination in a case like this?
Well, I think you get into the issues of whether or not that's going to invade the personal medical information. But I think also we have to follow.
It doesn't reveal, for example, if there were some other diagnoses in the medical records that the doctor didn't want published.
Well, I think there could be issues.
And that once you waive the privilege, it's waived. So everything comes in. But an independent medical examination, for example, to draw blood to do testing for a particular disease controlled by a court doesn't seem to me to be beyond the realm of possibility.
I think that can open the door to some problems, because then it becomes whether or not at the time of the incident and whether or not the IME is done in the course of discovery much later,
yes,
are there issues about whether or not a person had that disease at the time, when it was contracted, whether or not they still have it, whether or not treatment has affected it. So I think if the allegations deal with point A and then point B much later during litigation, there could be issues of whether or not medically there is a connection, depending upon what that examination reveals. But that's not the situation we have here. They were asking personal medical information of a non-party.
So you said it doesn't make any difference whether the physician, the person in this case, was a party or not. Would you explain that? I mean, that seems to be even more troubling, that somebody can be a carrier and infect everybody, and there's no way of anybody that's infected of ever getting this information because of the statutory physician-patient privilege.
Well, I believe that it would have to be a case-by-case analysis on that. But I think what we're dealing with here, though, is the legal deficiency of the decision that has come right out and said that a patient is not a protected source. And the basis of the Ninth District decision is that. It didn't go into anything else about alternative ways of discovery. It came right out and said that a patient is not a protected source, and that is completely contrary to Roe versus Planned Parenthood, Cepeda versus Lutheran Hospital, and Medical Mutual Schlatterer. And I think Medical Mutual is on point, that this court recently said that in order for there to be discovery of personal medical information, there has to be an express waiver or consent by the patient.
So Mr. Leake, go ahead.
Mr. Leake, you're saying a single question to the doctor, did you have hepatitis B the time of the surgery? A single question like that is the same as the other cases where we're talking about documents of patients, where we're talking about questions of doctors to their patients. You're equating a single fact question to a non-party as identical to those other cases.
Yes, and the reason is it's the information being sought. It's the
You're saying that medical information is sacrosanct.
Pursuant to this court's authority, especially Roe versus Planned Parenthood, Dr. Debski is a non-party, and therefore his personal medical information cannot be subject to discovery in someone else's lawsuit.
And I thought I heard you say that it doesn't matter if he was a party or a non-party. You're taking the same position?
Well, I think what I'm doing here is then relying upon Callahan versus Fullen, which dealt with a case where the defendant doctor was a party, and that under those circumstances of that case, the court stated, although relevant, the confidentiality of the medical records and information of the doctor in that case was privileged.
So the medical condition would be absolutely inviolate, you're saying?
I believe if you look at it as a non-party and a party, we have to protect the patient, and they are a protected source.
What's the recourse for the wards, Mr. Wards of the world, in this situation where you do have physicians that are engaging in a treatment and surgery and are not, they're doing so with conditions that are proved to be dangerous to their patients. And I'll give you an example. Let's say we're not talking about hepatitis. What if you have a doctor who is drug involved and they're treated for a drug condition and they're relapsing and going into surgery and causing serious harm as a result of their drug involvement? Would your answer be the same?
I think following the reasoning in Callahan is that the relevancy versus, you know, what they need to do to obtain proof for their case is a case-by-case analysis. But I think this case is unique, though, because Dr. Debski is a non-party, and that's our primary position here.
Well,
is that
all right, now I'm confused. If it's sacrosanct that you just told Justice Lanzinger that, you know, this is off-limits under all conditions, and I just gave you the scenario where you've got a drug-involved physician malpracticing as a result of their drug involvement, and that's a medical condition, you know, and you say that could be discoverable?
I think it's a case-by-case analysis of what the circumstances are, whether or not there's other proof of the condition, whether or not there was a suspension with the medical board. I think that's the distinction, is that you have to look at those by case-by-case.
Well, but say there's not. I mean, say we've got the issue, the information to be gleaned by the plaintiff is the drug involvement of the physician for which he has received treatment. Okay? Are you saying under those scenarios that the drug involvement, the addiction, is not admissible? It's not discoverable and it's not admissible?
I think it can be under the circumstances of that case. If there is proof, instead of just, for instance, if someone had a history of alcohol abuse in 2000 and then they tried to get into medical records from 2009, but there was no basis, I think it's a case-by-case analysis of what is relevant to that particular case and what the plaintiffs need to prove their case.
Well, wasn't in this situation, correct me if I'm wrong, that he showed signs of jaundice and symptoms of hepatitis after the surgery?
Well, I don't think we ever got to that point in terms of what I think the issue here, though, is should he have been compelled to disclose his personal medical information obtained within the communications?
And what's the difference between that and the drug-involved physician?
I think that under this case, Dr. Debski is a non-party. His medical information is absolutely protected under Roe versus Planned Parenthood, just like Bednarik in the Seventh District said. And so I think this case is unique in terms of he's a non-party being asked to disclose in someone else's lawsuit his personal medical information.
Well, in Roe, didn't we have some other parties involved here, there? For example, they tried to get an entity to disclose the records of other patients. Mm-hmm. That's a couple extra steps in there than what's involved here, isn't there?
Right. And but what this court did in Roe versus Planned Parenthood was said that it is the patient's privilege and right to privacy and confidentiality that will be protected. And that's why we have to look at the intent of
when
the
legislature. When you're asking a third party to disclose the patient's records, that was the scenario in Roe, if I recall correctly.
Correct. And so the problem with the reasoning.
You're not asking the third party. You're asking the first party in this case, the patient themselves.
Exactly. And that's the problem with the Ninth District opinion, is that they acknowledge that the patient is the exclusive holder of the physician-patient privilege, just like long-established law in Ohio has been like this. It is the patient under Medical Mutual Schlatter that must provide express consent or a waiver of that.
That's
privilege.
For the physician to release the information, not for the patient themselves to speak about themselves. That's the trouble I'm having with your argument here. And the same thing with Roe. The holder of the records was asked to, you know, release that information. Here, whatever the treating entity was for the doctor is not being asked to release information. It's the doctor himself. He doesn't have a universal privilege that relates to him. His privilege is he cannot, if he chooses not to, release the medical provider to talk about him. But there's nothing to say he can't talk about himself.
Well, I mean, if you take the reasoning of the Ninth District and then apply it to every patient in Ohio, in any case, then, a plaintiff, I don't know what circumstances, it could be an automobile accident or it could be a class action suit or something like that. Under the reasoning of the Ninth District, any patient can be compelled to disclose personal medical information because
if it's relevant to the situation at hand, and we certainly could take the Ninth District's opinion and craft it in a way where this court's opinion is the final word, and if it requires, you know, a narrowing of that approach, that's what we do all the time. So, you know, I don't think that's a compelling reason here.
But I think the key is that the decision is legally flawed because they concluded that the patient is not a protected source. In light of the fact that they admit that the patient is the exclusive holder of the physician-patient privilege under 2317.02b1.
Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Elliott.
Chief Justice Brown, may it please the court. My name is Michael Elliott. I'm here on behalf of the appellees, Donald and Susan Ward.
Can you just help me with a little bit with the procedure on this? Why was the doctor not sued? Has he settled out, or is it?
Well, we took a very cautious approach. There's certainly a lot of evidence within the record at this point in time to suggest the doctor was the cause and the source of the infection. We know from the evidence in this case that it occurred while in the operating room. We got further evidence from the hospital that the healthcare worker was not employed to the hospital. So that limited it to the appellant and two other individuals. We found out that one of the other patients of this same healthcare worker later tested positive for hepatitis B. So while we believe there's would be a strong case against him, we wanted to take a reasoned, caution approach. It is a sensitive area. We certainly did not want to needlessly bring a claim against somebody in a formal sense.
Did the hospital volunteer all that information to you?
The information I just described, we were able to find that out through the deposition of the director of infectious disease. They redacted certain information, but certain information in a more generic sense was shared to us. They wouldn't identify the exact individual by name.
But when they told your client you may get sick, they didn't give you all the client all
no,
those
in
details.
Fact, they took an approach where they weren't going to tell them a thing, and that led to this lawsuit. They said, come in, you've been exposed to somebody with hepatitis B while your visit to the hospital.
So in essence, in response to where Justice, what I think she's asking is, why'd you sue the hospital first and not the doctor? The hospital invited that by refusing to disclose anything.
It was clear they had that information, that knowledge. And when we first brought the suit, we never really thought that we would not be able to find out at least the source of the individual who caused the exposure. This is all new to us in terms of suggesting that there should be some privilege in effect. There's certainly a privilege here that's at issue, but I do not believe it's a privilege that applies to these circumstances. I think the court has rightly shown through its questioning. The case and the focus of this case is simply, does the physician-patient privilege apply in these circumstances? We know there has to be a communication. The holder is also a component of that privilege, and then there has to be a protected source. Even though much of the information that we desire from the appellant would not be a communication for purposes of this appeal, we acknowledge that the question, did you have hepatitis B at the time of the surgery, may very well be a communication. He is the holder. And those cases that the appellant points to, the Roe decision, this court's decision in Schottler, are both cases that really deal with the holder and the right that the holder has to exercise the privilege or to waive the privilege.
But counsel, getting back to the procedure here, so Dr. Debsky is not in any way going to be on the hook here, whether he answers your question or not. Is that true? It's too late to sue him?
At this point in time, he's not a party. That's an issue for a latter day. There are statute of limitations issues here. I don't know whether or not he would be brought in at some point in time or not. There could be an equitable tolling of the statute. There is case law. We've had obviously great opposition to getting this information, which has delayed this case by the occurrence was in 2006. The case was filed in 2008. So we're now 2 years down the road and still have not gotten this information.
Well, counsel, backing up to, I guess, things that aren't before us, what you sued the hospital.
There's a case pending against the hospital.
And in that suit, what I assume is critical, since they're saying, well, it's the doc, not us, and he's not a contract employee or anything else. He's an independent contractor. What's critical in that suit, I assume, is what did they know and when did they know it, or when should they have known it? And your problem with the doctor, the hospital's claiming attorney-client privilege and those kinds of things. Did the Court of Appeals correct that sufficiently for you that you can get the information you need, or is the doctor still critical to determining that?
The doctor is still critical, and I'll tell you why. The Court of Appeals found that the trial court had not exercised the opportunity to conduct an in-camera inspection. But short of having a decision from this court that states that this is not a protected source, if you look at the statute, the statutory language makes clear what is a protected source. This, in fact, is not a protected source. And if that decision is, if this court does not decide that, does not correctly decide that this is not a protected source, then it goes back to the trial court. The trial court exercises its right to find, okay, well, maybe this is not peer review, but it's still a physician-patient privileged confidential communication, which we're not going to allow. So it's necessary that we also have the decision from this court, which finds that it's not. I think Justice Kupp was correct in suggesting that the gist of this argument, which appellant is making, would be taken at its logical end. It would deny anybody who's ever been exposed to anybody, and we could think about hypotheticals here all day. You're exposed to someone who has AIDS. You're in a train, a bus, a plane with someone who has TB. In all those circumstances, if appellant's argument is successful, someone who's exposed to that, or a group of individuals who are exposed to that, will never be able to find that information out. They would be foregone from doing so. And
what would be the cause of action you could file against such an individual if you could determine the source of the infection?
Well, it would depend upon the facts and circumstances.
Wouldn't be medical malpractice, though, would it?
It would not. It could be as simple as a negligence action. Someone knowingly gets on a plane. It could be an assault. It could be a number of different things.
So if you sued that person, could a court order an independent medical examination or not?
That's an issue that I have not looked at. But certainly the relief that we are seeking and have requested is much less onerous than that. I mean,
You can get a blood test just with one vial of blood, can you not?
And I'm not an infectious disease expert, so I don't
know. You don't work for the CDC?
No, I'm sorry. It's not my second job. But I don't know if that would reveal hepatitis B at this stage or not. And like I said, we're looking for the least amount of burden possible.
So, Mr. Elliott, are you saying that this opinion could be narrowed, or would you comment on the?
Most definitely, Your Honor.
All right. That's what we've said. And you would have no problem with narrowing the language so that it would not be seen to say that any patient could be compelled to disclose a medical condition.
Well, what I think ought to happen is that the court should exercise the powers available to it through 26 and otherwise. I don't want to see anyone have to undergo something that will invade their matters of privacy and make that a public matter. So I think protective orders, in-camera inspections can all be utilized, in this case and others, to prevent that from happening. What I don't want to have or see happen is that the appellant's argument is successful in stating that this is yet another protected source, because as I think it's been shown today by the questions of the court, you know, there's all sorts of circumstances that would prevent people from finding out information that's important to them. And going back to the basis of this whole case, my client was the patient here. My client was exposed to a disease while in the hospital, and now he's unable to find out his own medical information. That became a part of his medical information when that happened to him. So you're trumping his medical rights by someone else's medical rights.
Mr. Elliott, does the status of the doctor make any difference really here in your perspective? Does it matter that the doctor here was a non-party as opposed to a party in the case?
I don't believe that non-party should make a difference because, like I said, We certainly probably could have brought him in as a party, and we certainly had enough evidence at one point to do so. But the fact that we didn't, we were trying to exercise caution. And
so, in your view, the rule should be the same.
I do believe so. Yes, I don't believe the decisions referred to earlier, the Roe decision.
Mr. Elliott, does it matter that Mr. Debski is a physician himself?
Well, it would certainly possibly allow him to self-diagnose himself. So if he, in fact, knows he had hepatitis B at some point or had a reasonable suspicion of having hepatitis B without even seeing a doctor, another doctor, I should say, that would even throw this analysis in further disarray. How is someone supposed to deal with that type of situation?
Does it matter that you're asking Mr. Debski himself as opposed to asking some physician who treated Mr. Debski?
Most definitely. Under those circumstances, under the present statute, we should not, nor should we be able to find that information out. I think in the Roe decision, Justice O'Donnell's concurrence and dissent in part pointed out a good point, and I think counsel's even sort of conceded this point, but possibly there should be some sort of weighing or case-by-case analysis. The statute doesn't provide for that, and I'm not suggesting here today that ought to be the law. If that's something that needs to be addressed, just like the issue that appellant is requesting, that's something for the legislature to decide. But under this law, under this statute, it is clear that they don't have the basis to ask for the relief they seek.
And you mentioned the civil rules and the potential for protective order and some of those kinds of things. Is there any reason for this court to speak to those matters, or are they already self-evident and contained in the civil rules of procedure?
Well, I think they are there. I think it would be common sense on the part of the court to do that. Certainly, if this court wishes to speak to that issue, just to reinforce that, that would certainly be something that would be reasonable. If there's no other questions, I'll...
Mr. Elliott, thank you.
Thank you.